Thank you. I am pleased and delighted to be here this morning. And if at any time you can't hear me, just wave your hands in case I put the microphone down. Or... Oh, that would be good. That sounds good. Well, let me know if you can't hear me. Spirit and fire, the first Pentecost. All the apostles looked at one another. Words hurled in fire through the returning gloom. Something had changed and colored all the room. The beauty of the Galilean mother took the breath from them for a little space. Even a cup, a chair, or a brown dress could draw their tears with a great loveliness that wrote tremendous secrets every place. That was the day when fire came down from heaven, inaugurating the first spring of love. Blood melted in the frozen veins, and even the least bird sang in the mind's inmost grove. The seeds sprang into flower, and overall still do the multitudinous blossoms fall. This is from a poem by Jessica Powers written in 1937. Intentional Eucharistic communities, a going back to the first Pentecost experience, a remembering of our beginnings, a desire to return to a time of community building, to a time of spiritual awakening, to a time of deep understanding of spirit and fire. This morning I would like to review with you the birth and the ongoing development of intentional Eucharistic communities, which are necessarily a part of the emerging church. And then I will share with you a brief history of the Roman Catholic woman priest movement and how this movement intersects with the intentional Eucharistic communities. And hopefully, I will also share with you about the Church of the Beatitudes, which has been in existence for over a year. I struggled with the material because there is so much, and there is a bit of confusion between intentional Eucharistic communities, which I will be referring to as another acronym for you to learn, IEC. So when you hear IEC, just fill in intentional Eucharistic communities. Then there are small church communities. And then there are small Christian communities. The subject of this talk this morning is going to be on small Eucharistic communities and small church communities, which are almost interchangeable. And the way I thought I would organize this material is to trace the origin and progress through the three national conferences of the intentional Eucharistic communities here in the United States. So let's begin with a definition of intentional Eucharistic communities. They are the small faith communities rooted in the Catholic tradition, which gather to celebrate on a regular basis. All are characterized by shared responsibility for the governance and life of the community. Through sharing liturgical life and mutual support for one another, members are strengthened to live gospel-centered lives dedicated to to spiritual growth and spiritual commitment. Most of the IECs were born in the enthusiasm flowing from Vatican II for a church of the people. Some IECs were instituted in parishes. Some were created as alternative to the parish, and some retained close ties with the institutional church, while others functioned independently. So you see, within that definition, there are wide parameters for how IECs choose to operate. In another term, they are called small church groups. Marinus Father Mike Bernard Lee, together with Michael Cohen, wrote a book called Dangerous Memory. I have a list of books. I have some books on the table over there, and I'll put these out that you can look at. None of them are for sale except the one on the Women Find a Way. In this book, authors of Dangerous Memories, House Church in Our American Society, the author, Father Lee, states that the United States has at least 15,000 small church communities. And yet the American Catholics, by meeting in these small church communities, are not doing anything unique. During the last 2 decades, at least 100,000 basic Christian communities, communities de Basso, you've probably heard of those from Latin America, they've developed in the Brazilian church, where the influence of liberation theology has become widespread. The small church community movement has reached thousands throughout Africa, the Philippines, and Europe. And Lee identifies 4 common characteristics of small Christian communities. Koinonia, all small Eucharistic communities and small church communities have these 4 characteristics they share in common. Koinonia, community. That is perhaps the greatest call for people to have formed intentional communities. Diaconia, service or mission. There is a strong social dimension to small church communities. It is not only speaking about social justice, but finding ways to involve themselves in work of social justice. Kerygma. The small Eucharistic communities are deeply rooted in the gospel. And I might add one other thing that they are rooted in, or one other tradition, and that is the documents of Vatican II. So I would say the Gospels first and then Vatican II second. And liturgia, and that is Eucharist. So how IECs differ from small Christian communities is they are Eucharistically based. You know, many years ago we had the Renew Movement, and the whole idea of the Renew Movement was to create small Christian communities within a parish setting. And many parishes did that, the mission did that, and I think that some of them might still be in existence, and I know at St. Joseph's, when I was working there, they have had Renew about 20 years ago. Then we had a second Renew program, but some of the people who had been in that group 20 years ago were still meeting. So they were meeting as a small community, and they had a lot of the elements of IECs, except they weren't structured or set up as a Eucharistically based community. They were operating within the main frame of the church and going back for their liturgies to the church. Now, it is difficult to put a number on these small intentional Eucharistic communities because they're found in many, many places. They are found in women church groups. They are found in peace and justice centers. They are found in migrant worker camps, on college campuses. Many of these groups choose to be autonomous, and some prefer anonymity to avoid attracting the attention of the bishops and pastors who want to maintain control of their liturgies. So IECs usually invite an ordained celebrant, usually a friend or member of the community who has a link to the Universal Church, to preside at Eucharist. Others find a celebrant within the small circle of the small community, and this relates to the experience of the early church. When instead of ordaining someone and sending that person to lead a community, local communities ordained one of their own. So there are a number of ways that the IECs have met and have structured themselves. And because of the desire of many groups for anonymity, it has been difficult to find out just how many are in existence or what they're doing. But you know, human nature being what it is, there was a need, or there became a need, for the small IECs to somehow come together and somehow begin to share what was happening in their areas. The first really strong movement of the intentional Eucharistic communities happened in the Washington, D.C. area, and it happened after Vatican II. So they started putting out feelers. Where did they put these things out? In Voice of the Faithful, Call to Action, Corpus. These are some of the main people that were linking themselves to small intentional communities. And they established a conference. And so I'm going to talk about the growth of these movements through looking at three national councils that they have had, and sharing with you and letting you see what the involvement has been like, and where the Roman Catholic Women Priest Movement fits into this. The first national conference was held in May of 1991 in Washington, D.C. area. And that was called a Conversation of Intentional Eucharistic Ministers, Communities. It was attended by about 155 participants from 15 communities. And in this particular conference, it was a time to hear one another's stories and to support one another's endeavors. I think, like any movement, when you have something that begins to be going well, or even if there are difficulties within the structure, but it's going fairly well, you want to have that feeling that you're not alone, that there are others that are doing the same thing that you are doing. And it becomes tremendously affirming to have that realization. And basically, that's what happened at the first national conference. It was just an awareness and that others are seeing the same thing, experiencing the same thing, wanting to do this, and talking about what their experience has been like and what has been happening in other communities. Now, 10 years later, there was a second conference. And this was also held in Washington in May of 2001. And the title of this one was A Gathering of Intentional Eucharistic Communities. The first was a conversation. This one is a gathering, shaping and celebrating our faith. Over 240 members representing 41 communities, along with an impressive slate of presenters, came together to celebrate this way of being church. So in 10 years' time, you had a number of theologians beginning to take a look at what was happening and deciding that they would like to do the historical studies about this and begin doing some presenting of the and form panels affirming the place of the IECs rather, in the history and tradition of the church. This was a big step forward.
Can I ask you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any names, key people in such a movement?
I will in the third movement. They were just beginning to gather, but the two names that I will be mentioning are Sheila Betts and Carl Warner. It wasn't clear in this particular one who the theologians, they were going back basically to the historical understanding of the early church and the forming of the small Christian communities in the gospel of, in the epistles of Paul and the Acts of the Apostles and those kinds of things. But there wasn't any prominent theologian.
Well, what about the ordinary lay people? I mean, who were the movers and shakers? Are there any names in there?
No, but I will tell you that if you are interested in history, it would be the Catholic Experience of Small Christian Communities. And this book would give you, this is a study that was done of the small Christian communities. Again, in this particular book, it does not come out with names of the primary shakers and movers. It isn't until the third conference that you start getting a real strong identification with who they are, the shakers and movers.
And that was Bernard Lee also.
This one is Bernard Lee also. The time together at this conference enabled participants to look in more detail at various elements of community life, liturgical renewal, social commitment, relation to the institution, IECs as alternative faith communities, nurturing spiritual growth, developing community life, creating meaningful rituals. But one of the key factors that seem to have emerged from this particular time after 10 years of gathering together was the realization that what was happening at IECs, the Intentional Eucharistic Communities, was the maturing faith of adult Christian people. Instead of seeing the people as someone to be spoken down to or taught or have different things imposed on them, they saw this as a group of emerging Catholic men and women who fought for themselves and were able to begin to express from a wealth of really good background. It's interesting. I'm still pondering your question. I think one of the reasons that I'm not coming up with any names in this research is because it came up from so many of the laity. And it's not necessarily that they were big names. It was really that they were people who were coming together to share and explore and really share and their ideas and where they would be going. And one of the key elements back in 2001, which you're going to see really re-emerging in the next conference, is this idea of their relation to the institution. It was never clear. I think when I was in San Jose, and I'm not even remembering, it was about 20 or 30 years ago, I was invited to attend a small intentional community. And it was held with a priest who had retired. And the bishop at that time knew what was happening and allowed it, quote, to happen within the tradition. So they were still under the auspices of the Roman Church. He, as far as I know, his small community is still going, even to this day. He's had a heart attack, he's recuperated, and he's continuing in his small Christian communities. But much happened in the understanding and maturity of small Christian communities between 2001 and 2009, when the third national conference was held. Okay, yeah. You know what's on my handouts, because Tom made them for me. Thank you. As is so typical for us in the United States, after something has been in existence for a while, we want to research it, and we want to do surveys, and we want to find out a little bit more about it. So as early as 1986, Bernard Lee and Michael Cohen were evaluating the impact of house church or intentional Christian communities or intentional IECs in the United States. One of the difficulties with all of this is the languaging. In some of the research, they are called small church communities. In others, they are called intentional Christian communities. In others, they are called IECs. So you have to keep your mind open all the time and realize that most of the time, the IECs, the intentional Christian communities, and the small church communities are pretty much one and the same. Small Christian communities is something entirely different. In their book, Dangerous Memories, Lee and Cohen posited that the house church, or intentional Christian community, had begun to reconstruct the ecclesial life of Christians in the United States. In this book, the authors examined the contemporary experience of intentional Christian communities from the perspective of scripture, history, psychology, and social theory. In some ways, the small IECs or small church communities were sensing the changes in the paradigm and beginning to live it without fully understanding it. Isn't that always the way when we are in a paradigm shift? That there are small groups that through the movement of the Spirit start to feel this is right, this is something we've got to go with, this is something we've got to experiment with, and begin some type of a movement without fully understanding what it's all about, but knowing and sensing that in the Spirit it is the right thing to be doing. So while they were living it, others began to study it and evaluating this phenomenon. Bernard Lee and his colleagues undertook a wide-ranging study of small Christian communities in an attempt to see what kind of people joined them, how the members practiced their faith while together, and how the experience changed their outlook as Catholics. The book, The Catholic Experience of Small Christian Communities, this one here, is a report of that study. So for those of you who are really interested in sociological studies and taking a look at how all of this emerged, I would strongly recommend this book by Bernard Lee. It gives a very detailed understanding. The findings suggest that small Christian communities represent a new way of being church, a way that is entirely voluntary, formed by personal relationships and with a social agenda. Now, why I bring up the findings here is that the findings of this book were presented at the 3rd National Conference in May of 2009. So we had moved from a conversation to a much more intense presentation at the 3rd National Conference. And during the years between the 2nd and 3rd National Conference is when a theology underpinning the growth of small Christian communities was beginning to be formulated. And you need to hear the words beginning to be formulated, because nothing is set in stone in this movement. Everything is very fluid right now because they haven't been in existence long enough. But two theologians in particular were examined, Karl Rahner and Shilovetz. From The Shape of the Church to Come by Karl Rahner, we get the following quote. The church of the future will be built from below by basic communities as a result of free initiative and association. We should make every effort not to hold up this development, but to promote it and direct it. Basic communities will, in fact, emerge from below, even though it will be a call from the gospel and the message of the church coming out of the past. The emerging church? Basic communities will, in fact, emerge from below, Karl Rahner. Schellebeck was interviewed by a number of people. I wrote down the main author, and I'm not remembering who the person is who went into Holland and studied the Dutch theologians in the church. I'm sure the name will come. It's in my bibliography. But he said that reading Schellebeck meant reading a reconsidered Catholic Church, particularly on the issue of ordination, which the theologian argues was a matter of community choice. The community appointed its pastors. Gradually, the bishop, also originally chosen by the community, became the locus of all authority in the matter of ordination. Schellebeck goes on to say that nobody's got to do this, but we should consider it. He says, always, this involves a little bit of illegality. A little bit of illegality. But we shouldn't worry about that, because the church never got anywhere unless somebody was willing to do a little illegality. And then he says something else that I think is very pertinent. Those who seek reform should not complain about the bishops, nor expect too much from the hierarchy, since bishops are the takers of the old orders, and they don't understand what you're doing. They cannot understand what you are doing, because they are trained to understand the old order. They are the caretakers of the old order. The old order is in their bones. You can't ask them to think outside the box, because they are paid by the box. Now, another major happening occurred between the second and third national conference, and that is the birth and development of the Roman Catholic woman priest. On the 29th of June, 2002, seven women went on a ship in the Danube, prepared to be ordained by a Roman Catholic bishop with apostolic succession. For years before, they had met one another in monasteries and other places, had lit candles, hoped and wept, argued and wrung their hands. Their aim was clear. They all wanted to be ordained as Roman Catholic women priests. They were well qualified, but the Vatican did not allow women to be ordained. Therefore, the women had to begin the process on their own. In this book, which is the book that your handout is taken, and I gave you that particular handout because I wanted you to see that the beginning of the Roman Catholic or the ordination movement began long before this date of June 29th, 2002. At the beginning of the Second Vatican Council, and even before it, two women theologians, Ida Rahming, well, she's the one that published this one, so I'll just talk about Ida Rahming, and this version is edited by Bernard Cook and Gary Macy. They had been studying for years the role of women in the Roman Catholic Church. Ida Rahming wrote a note to the then head of the theology of the Vatican Council, Ratzinger. Mm-hmm. He was not Pope at the time. And she asked that the issue of Roman Catholic women's ordination be put on the agenda for the Second Vatican Council. In this book, I believe it's in this one, because this is volume two, I'm not sure if it was in volume one or volume two, was a copy of the letter that was written to Ratzinger, and then there is also a copy of the response. I think that's in their autobiography. They gave me a copy of it written in Germany, but they pointed out to me what the letters were saying. One of it was a petition to Ratzinger that this be included in the Second Vatican Council, and the other one was Ratzinger's response that that would indeed not happen. But what you'll find in this book is all the background material, both sociological, psychological, anthropological, and theological, studying the whole movement of women in the early church, what happened when the women who had been ordained in the early church. I'll talk about that a little bit more when I talk about Roman Catholic women priests. But it's a book written in German, translated. It's very, as you know, the German theologians are very copious with their words. So it's not an easy reading book. It's not a book that you would take and read at night before you go to bed. But it's a very, very well researched. Ida Rahming was one of the first seven women priests. She is currently a bishop in Stuttgart, Germany. And she wrote her doctoral dissertation at a Catholic university on the ordination of women. The man who was her, what do you call him?
Advisor.
Yeah, the advisor. Yeah, he reluctantly allowed it. He was very reluctant. And then, because of the meticulousness of her research, he was totally overwhelmed and had to accept it and pass it because of the meticulousness of the research itself. So she got her degree and her doctoral degree and got the book published. And part of the history of women's ordination is her doctoral dissertation on her study. So it happened that the Roman Catholic women priest community was born. I have a book that I brought with me that's called Women Find a Way. I think I have about five copies, and those can be for sale. I think they're $20 each. But I love the title, Women Find a Way, because that's exactly what happened. As doors were shut, as no's were coming, they found a way. So let me spend a little bit of time telling you about the movement of the Roman Catholic women priests. The goal of the Roman Catholic women priest community is to bring about the full equality of women in the Roman Catholic Church. The movement Roman Catholic women priests does not perceive itself as a countercultural movement against the Roman Catholic Church. It wants neither a schism nor a break from the Roman Catholic Church, but rather wants to work positively within the church. As a movement, we invite our Roman Catholic Church leaders to join us in an open, respectful dialogue so that together we may serve the church faithfully and lovingly. To date, this has not happened, but we are still asking for it. We are still remaining open to it. We have people like Roy Bourgeois. We have a number of bishops even that are secretly supportive, but because they are being paid by the box, you can't think outside the box. But we are seeing more and more that priests and some bishops are taking great risks to at least let us know that they're supporting us, but the dialogue has not yet begun. In her address, Prophetic Obedience, the Experience and Vision of Roman Catholic Women Priests, to the Southeast Pennsylvania's Women's Ordination Conference in March 2005, Bishop Patricia Frezen, Doctor of Theology, said, "Now we in the church are under another long walk to freedom. This time, freedom from sexism, from unjust discrimination against women in the church, freedom from oppression by the privileged clerical caste in the church. Once again, we need to stand in protest to break the unjust laws because we cannot wait forever. And we need, at least at this beginning, to move into the structures that already exist and change them. We are loyal members of the church who stand in the prophetic tradition of holy obedience to the Spirit's call to change an unjust law that discriminates against women. We are obeying well-formed and well-informed consciences. As Cardinal Walter Kasper, the former bishop of Rottenburg, Stuttgart, Germany, and currently president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, wrote, quote, "Some situations oblige one to obey God and one's own conscience rather than the leaders of the church. Indeed, one may even be obliged to accept excommunication rather than act against one's own conscience." End of quote. In obedience to the gospel of Jesus, the Roman Catholic women priests are disobeying an unjust law that discriminates against women. Canon 1024 in the canon law structure states that only a baptized male may receive holy orders. But this is in contradiction to Canon 849 of the same code of canon law, which states that baptism is the gateway to the sacrament, which includes holy orders. Baptism is the foundation of the validity of holy orders, not maleness. Thus, Code 1024 denies full membership to women in the church and contradicts Canon 849, which opens all the sacraments to all members of the church. In other words, the sacrament of baptism makes us equal in Christ. St. Paul taught, "As many of you as were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer servant or free. There is no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus." From Galatians. For 1,200 years, some popes, bishops, and scholars accepted women's ordination as equal to men. So there is a precedent in the history of our church. A well-guarded secret, I might add. I don't know if you're aware of this, but until Vatican II, much of the library in the Vatican was sealed. And we could not get at these documents. We could not read the history. And of course, history has been revisioned, and some history was eliminated and all that. But after Vatican II, when the library was opened and reopened, there's been a lot more study done. In the 10th century, Bishop Atto of Vercelli wrote about the early church practice of ordaining women to preside over the churches because of the great need. In 1976, the Pontifical Biblical Commission concluded that there is no biblical reason to prohibit women's ordination. This commission was put together after Vatican II, Because if you've read the documents on the church and the documents of Vatican II, the seeds for ordination for not only women priests but married priests are contained within the very documents. So as a follow-up to some of those documents, a commission was established, a biblical commission, to study, is there anything in Scripture that would be prohibitive to the ordination of women? And they said that there was absolutely no reason. How did the Vatican respond? The committee was dissolved. Absolutely, it's exactly the same thing that happened with the birth control commission, because they had psychologists and doctors and all kinds of things, and the findings was not the way they were hoping, and so they dissolved the committee and hoped that the results wouldn't be made known. Now, Pope John Paul II contradicted the early tradition of women in priestly ministry when he wrote, "The Church has no authority whatsoever to confer priestly ordination on women, and this judgment is to be definitively held by all the Church's faithful." However, Pope John Paul II did not consult the people of God, including the theologians and the bishops, before issuing that decree. So the Church has always taught that infallible teaching must reflect a sense of the faithful. Therefore, this teaching is not infallible because it does not reflect the sensum fidelium, the faith of the believing community. In fact, according to recent surveys, about 70% of Catholics in the United States approve of women's ordination, including some of the world's bishops. The Church cannot continue to discriminate against women and blame God for it. So people ask, but what about your vow of obedience? To a child, obedience is doing what you are told. For an adult, obedience is discerning and following God's direction in our lives. Roman Catholic women priests do not take a vow of obedience to the bishop. Our obedience is to the gospel as we discern together God's guidance for our community. Roman Catholic women priests reject the penalty of excommunication issued by the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith on May 29, 2008, stating that the women priests and the bishops who ordained them would be excommunicated late sententiae. Women and men are created in God's image, and both may represent Christ as priests. Therefore, the women in the Roman Catholic women priest movement do not accept this general excommunication. Women as priests remind us that women are equal symbols of the holy, and that the identity of priests should reflect the experience of spiritual authority and spiritual authority of women. Women priests help the Church to recognize women's rightful place as equals in the governing structures of the Church. Reclaiming our ancient spiritual heritage, women priests are creating and shaping a more inclusive, Christ-centered, Spirit-empowered Church of Equals in the 21st century. Now, why I'm bringing that in at this intersection is that I think I've got about 5 to 11. Maybe we'll go to the third.
5 minutes.
Okay. I think I'll go to the third national conference. That's the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. You will see that at the third national conference, which was held in May of this year in Chevy Chase, Maryland, it was embracing and shaping our future. And that there were three general sessions religion and spirituality among the IEC members, the prophetic nature, women in ministry, true Roman Catholic women priests were invited to share their stories, and the third general session was a social justice at local, national, and international levels. So you can see that in the 10 years, or about 9 years between the second conference and the third conference, women had been invited to come and attend. I think there are several reasons for that. You know, when we first began our church community, the Church of the Beatitudes, our beloved Tom here kept pressing me that we were an intentional Eucharistic community. And I said, well, I don't think so. But I wasn't sure. But as I was doing this research, and then last summer, I went to the first annual retreat for Roman Catholic women priests held in Chicago, and learned from several of the priests in the Midwest area that they, in fact, had been invited by intentional communities to be the Eucharistic leaders at their meeting. And Sister Bridget Mary Meehan, who is a publicist, has written some articles on the intersection. I have to agree with you, Tom, that most of the Roman Catholic women priest communities are, in fact, would fit under the definition of the intentional Eucharistic communities. What has been happening nationwide is that many of the intentional Eucharistic communities would ask priests from universities to come and serve their communities. So they had many priests that were free to come. Now with the priest shortage, the priests at the universities are being asked to service the larger church, and they are no longer available to service many of the small Christian communities. And so the small Eucharistic communities and the small Christian communities are looking at the Roman Catholic women priest movement and inviting Roman Catholic women priests to come and serve in their particular community. So I think, I think before we take a break and I continue along with the presentation, are there any questions or reflections or anything?
Did most of the IEC identify as Roman Catholic or just Catholic? I know in your community, you're grappling with that too.
We're all grappling with that, and if there's a question, I'm going to break you up into groups for discussion, and that's going to be one of the questions that was left with at this third meeting about where do people stand vis-a-vis the institutional church. And it's a question I think that every individual Eucharistic community might answer a little differently.
So there's no clear pattern there.
There is no clear pattern. I'll tell you an interesting little tidbit I was going to say a little bit later on that, though. Because intentional Eucharistic communities tend to be a little more ecumenical. What distinguishes them is that they will accept gays in their membership, but they will also accept gay priests, gay women priests, gay male priests. Communion is an open table. Does that necessarily take us out of the Roman Church or not?
Sounds like Episcopal to me.
What does Corpus have a role in?
Corpus has had a major role in supporting the Roman Catholic Women Priest Movement, and interestingly enough, one of the units that we need to do is we need to mentor with a priest for liturgy, for the performance of the liturgical mass and the sacraments, and most of the time it is Corpus priests that have worked with our women.
Well, the reason I asked the question, you said that...
Explain Corpus.
Corpus is an organization that was for... Well, we got a Corpus member that's here. Yeah, explain Corpus, John.
Corpus has about a 30-year history. Started in the mid-70s. in Chicago. It became gradually a national organization. The outlook of Corpus today is an association for an inclusive priesthood. That is our general outlook. Male, female, married, single, gay, whatever, it makes no difference. An inclusive priesthood open to all the baptized. And Corpus is very supportive of RCWP. I don't really use the acronym sometimes.
Roman Catholic women priests.
But Roman Catholic women priests. And in fact, Roberta and I had the privilege at the ordination of four women bishops to be there as the Corpus representatives to present rings to the bishops. So I guess Latte Sententiae got us too.
What does the acronym Corpus stand for?
It originally stood for Corps of Reserve Priests United for Service. That was the origin. We haven't, that understanding is long past, and Corpus is simply, Corpus is Latin for body, so we are a body of people who are advocating an inclusive priesthood open to all the faithful. And it's evolved, and we may be small in numbers, and we're getting a little grayer over the years, but we're still, the bishops still pay attention to us, reluctantly. One of the things that happened around 1989-90, the bishops met in San Jose, and Corpus happened to be holding its national meeting at the same time, and there was an interface and an agreement to set up a dialogue between Corpus and the Bishops' Conference, which the Vatican promptly said, no, you can't do that. They said that to the bishops. They didn't say it to us, but so, so we do have a history.
The reason I asked the question is, you mentioned that the universities would send people to the IECs, and then maybe a few of the women priests are a smaller number right now, but is any of the Corpus people the servicing, in other words, then give their services to the IECs?
Do you know that?
I'd say yes.
I would say yes also.
A lot of priests in Corpus are members of intentional Eucharistic communities and are the liturgical presider or leader for those communities.
And I think the reason why we can't say it definitively is because a lot of this does not want to be public.
Under the radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's under the radar. I would assume that, but I can't say for sure. Possibly in the research that was done by Lee, some of that would be quoted, I'm not sure. But a lot of it is under the radar. All right, I think it's time for us to take our break. What do we have?
15 minutes.